and Miss Claire and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Charles and the committee for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is always a privilege to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank Cindy, who picked me up at the airport. It's wonderful. I don't know what it is about us. When we get the opportunity to do this, we go in a lot of airports around the country. And we never carry a big book under our arms. And I know I think there's something about each other that we just recognize. And but Cindy was very clever because she had a big sign with my name on it. And so I just had to walk up and greet her, and she's been absolutely wonderful. I'd like to greet the newcomers. I saw that countdown last night, and I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And hope that you'll keep coming back with an open mind and join us. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, in the back of the book is one of my favorite readings. It's entitled Spiritual Experience. And at the end of that reading, it says, contempt prior to investigation, believe a man in everlasting ignorance. So come on back and sit down and listen. That's what I was told when I was new. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a wineette. And in chapter 3, more about alcoholism, it describes the insane things that we sometimes continue to do to keep from doing step 1, 2, and 3. And in that list of insanities, it says we switch to natural wine. Man, I switch to Ripple. And that's not one of your natural wine. I don't think a single grape was ever near that stuff. I think they just put some chemicals in a bottle and shook it up real hard, probably put a little ether in it to give it some spirit. And they put it on the shelves, and by this time I had lost everything that was near and dear to me. My alcoholism, I am sure, had affected the lives of every single person that loves me, and I had to watch that my everything go, a successful career, a successful business, the house, the cars, and all those things, all those outside pleasures of life that I used to always think was going to make me sit and be somebody. And, God always gave me a lot of things, and alcoholism, and my alcoholism just kept taking it away. And there I was down in South Central Los Angeles, and I drank my way to the ghetto doing a dance with death. The problem when you're drinking and dancing with death is the music stops. And the music had stopped, and I kept trying to revive that music that was always so important in my life, and feel that feeling of that absolute magic when I took that first drink, which had been 27 years before. And there I was with my two younger children. My little daughter at the time was 8 years old, and my little son was about 12 and a half years old, and I had to take them down to that to live a lifestyle that they certainly were never used to. And they had nothing to say about the fact that they had a drunken mother who had no place else to go. So there I was with the drapes drawn, living on food stamps and welfare, and coming out of blackouts. I'm a real alcoholic, the kind that's described in the big book. And there I was sitting in an overstuffed chair with a terrycloth robe on, and I used to wear this bright red wig that had bangs. I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, and Harlem, and L.A., and I've lived in that jazz world for many, many years, out there walking the walk and talking the talk and sitting there coming out of blackouts at like 10, 11 o'clock at night and listening to my heart pound like a drum. And there were times it would beat so rapidly that I would think it was going to explode from pain. And I knew what I needed to do was get up out of that chair and get down to the nearest sleazy bar and crawl up on the stool. I was a club bar drinker and nightclub drinker and party person for years and years and years, and I'd crawl up on that stool and look in that mirror behind the bartender. Sometimes crying silent tears about broken dreams and unresolved relationships. And looking at all those other faces, looking in that mirror, probably feeling like the song about Eleanor Rigby, wondering where all those other lonely people were coming from. You know, loneliness is part of this disease. You know, in the big book, in A Vision for You, it says, some of us sought sundry places, looking for understanding, companionship, and approval. And there I was, you know, that's what I was looking for, because I just needed somebody to talk to while I listened to that empty laughter that you hear in those clubs. And then I, you know, I would see a lot of other faces looking in that mirror. I'm sure that they were having their own fantasies like I was. I still, until this day, and I'm, by the grace of God, from April the 9th, 1974, I'm 24 years and 7 months, and I think about 18 days or something like that, sober from that first meeting. And until this day, I don't remember how it happened that I met a lot of out-of-work airline pilots sitting on those stools. And once in a while, I would meet a neurosurgeon. And I remember as clearly as it was yesterday, one night I'm sitting there and this very attractive young man was on my left, and he looked over at me and smiled. He introduced himself. And he told me he was a retired lieutenant colonel for the United States Air Force. And I was really impressed because he looked about 25 years old. And he looked around. He was really nervous looking up and down that bar. I was worried there for a while. I thought we were going to have some military secrets here. Then he told me that actually he was a U-2 pilot. But at the time, I didn't know what a U-2 pilot was. And then he looked around a few more times and he said, I fly secret missions all over the world. I took a sip off my wine. I know I got a nutcase on my hands here. He looked around a few more times and he whispered in my ear, he said, last night I flew over Russia. I said, I know, darling, because I was with you. And I don't know, by the end of the legal drinking hour in L.A., which is 2 o'clock, by that time we were usually legends in our own heads. And I don't know what would happen between those sleazy bars and that little place where I lived. I would come to another time, and this time it's like 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was always seemed so cold, and it always seemed so dark. It always seemed darkest. You know, right before dawn. There I was in a fetal position in tall, wet grass. In California, in those tall palm trees, in the springtime around April, we call them night birds, come out around midnight until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, then we don't hear them anymore. And they don't sing, they squawk back and forth to each other. I could hear one of them answer on the next block over. And there I am, you know, in that making deals with God. I'm talking about that God I didn't believe in. You know, I'm another one who grew up in the Baptist church, and the God that I had heard about as a little girl growing up was not exactly the God that I did not care to understand, because I was always terrified of that God. But I was making deals. My favorite alcoholic prayer was, you know, if you get me out of this one. Dogs traveled in packs in that area where I was living at that time. And they too would come out at midnight because, you know, when you live in the ghetto, it's all about survival. And in those days, they had metal trash cans out on the sidewalk. And it would take several of those little dogs to push the can onto the street, and I could still hear the zing of the lid as it would hit that street and start rolling, and I would start, you know, those prayers. That little face of that beautiful little daughter of mine would come before me as I was trying to make these deals with God on what I was going to do. She'd come, her eyes would come before my face, and I could hear her and remember her saying to me things like, "Mom, you always promise that you're going to, you know, come to PTA meeting. All my friends' parents show up and you get drunk." And God, that hurt me so bad, because that is not, I never ever wanted to get drunk in my life. I just wanted to feel better and let my feelings get, that alcohol would put my feelings above the pain. And I'd look at her and I'd say, "But darling, you don't, you know, next time they have PTA meeting, just let me know. I'm, as I said, 24 years and 7 months and some days sober, and I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet." What would happen is Dr. Sifferis, in the front of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the doctor's opinion, talks about the phenomenon of craving would start. The minute my eyes were open, and I'd get up off that ground and spin around and try to get the dew off my shoulders and look around, see who's looking. And nobody, I'm telling you, nobody cared about how you looked down there in that ghetto, whether it was in 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning or 12 o'clock in the afternoon. But, you know, there was a lady that lived across the street. Now, I don't know if any of you guys had ever had a neighbor like that when I had. And I never met her. I really didn't go down there to become socially accepted in the community. But I just went down there because I knew I was going to die. And I didn't know I was going to die of alcoholism, but I just knew I was going to die because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I'd look over there, and I don't think that woman ever slept. I could, any time of the day or night, I'd look over there. And I knew she was there because I could see her curtains moving. You know, and after I get my cool look in the yard, I'd give her the finger. And if it was a bad morning, you know, I'd yell up, cut my hands and yell over there, and that's for the horse you rode in on. And I wasn't a very nice person in those days. And get up those steps and get through the front door, lean on the door, and I was dying. Physically, emotionally, and spiritually dying. Charged down that hall. I was so sick because I was drinking my meals by that time. Get to that bathroom, get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim. You know, sliding around on that cold porcelain trying to find a comfortable place to rest. And there were mornings that I was sure that I was going to throw up my very soul. Come out of the blackout again, another field position. Now, and I used to try to stop that spin. And I don't know about you, but I would be leaning there, and the two words I would always focus on to stop the spin was American Standard. Stamped on the bottom of that toilet, and get up off that floor and break the promise to my kids that, like, you know, tomorrow, Mama's not going down to the liquor store. You know, and that promise was all another promise out of the window. Get dressed. I was 65 pounds overweight, put on my tight jeans, put on my bad leather jacket, you know, shove on my dark glasses, and put on some starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders. My mode of transportation by this time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. And I put on my house slippers and slide past the door and get to the front door and open it quietly. Sneak down the steps feeling like a thief in the night. Cross the street past 3 houses, get down on the avenue. Stand outside that door and wait for the man to come. Finally, this clerk would come and open that door, and I'd trail in there behind him and stand at that counter and feel that feeling that talks about in the book about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Play those games. I was used to playing the games of life. I just didn't know how to live it. And he'd watch him put his change away, and he'd say things to me like, "What are you going to have this morning, darling?" Something about those guys early in the morning, they can be really cruel. I'm the only customer in there. And he'd say things to me like, "Who's drinking all this Ripple?" And I'd lean on the counter and look him straight down, and I'd say, "I have house guests." And he'd put it in the paper bag and play with the paper bag at the top of the ball. And then he'd say things to me like, "You give your house guests Ripple?" And I'd just take it out of his hands and get past the little plate glass window and get around on the side of the building. You know, my days of fine drinking had long been over. I didn't have to worry about Baccarat crystal glasses. And I didn't have to worry about proper stirrers and napkins and mood music. And the smiling faces of handsome men. You see, I was drinking, but you talked to the, in the big book about the gift that Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It was not about the effect. By this time, I'm drinking to just stay alive, to breathe in and out. And I just unscrew that top and just take that hit off that wine and go back and sit in that chair, stare out of that window. The dawn is coming up, probably feeling like the man who said, I had a dream last night that life was passing me by. I was no longer in the dreams of life. I'm sitting in an overstuffed chair dying of alcoholism, hearing those kids go into a dirty kitchen, fix their own breakfast and fix their own lunch, and I'm saying tomorrow I'm going to help them out. You know, we tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I'd sit there in that chair and wonder, how in the world had I ever gotten from that place to sitting in that chair? I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. Wonderful, wonderful parents. I'm the youngest of seven children. My parents were not alcoholics, and my brothers and sisters were not alcoholics. And I believe I'm one of the ones that was born restless, irritable, and discontented right out of the chute. Could have used a little drinky poo in the first grade just to get me to the second grade. Because once I got that alcohol in my hand, I was queen of the bee. You know, I was queen bee of it all. And my father, and I mentioned this because my father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian born in Cherokee, North Carolina, on the reservation there. And he grew up there and lived on that reservation until he was probably 21 or 22 years old, migrated to Georgia, met my mom, and had these kids, and they were wonderful, wonderful. And I had a lot of trouble with my mother and about my opinion about her. And I now know through many inventories it was just my perception of what they were like. And that's all been changed, you know, in sobriety for me, because I did exactly what I was told to do when I got here, reluctantly sometimes in the beginning, but is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I believe those steps are spiritual in principle and honoring the traditions of this program, and I have been able to work that out for me, and that is what we call, you know, clearing up the wreckage of the past. My father was an artist, and he was very successful there in Atlanta, and I remember going to Union Baptist Church, and I hated every minute of it. And when I was a senior in Booker T. Washington High School, I won an art scholarship that took me out of Atlanta. I had a lot of trouble in Atlanta because I grew up when it was segregated. And I remember being thrown off the streetcars. In those days, they had streetcars. And going downtown and, you know, getting thrown out of the stores. I didn't like, the system. And I had a lot of trouble with all of that that went on down there. And I realized today I tried to change it. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous I can't change anything but me. And I won that scholarship to go to Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And that's how I left Atlanta, sitting on a segregated train, waving my finger, you know. And I mean, I'm not going back there again. I've been back there many, many times in sobriety. What I realized going back there is what Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God has done for me in my life is I went back there with dignity, and I went back there, you know, loving every minute of it, that I was sober, and my perception of everything was different. I always had these secrets. I went to Boston with a lot of secrets. And the secret was that I never wanted to be an art student, and I never wanted to be an art teacher. This is what I was going to be trained for, because I always wanted to be a performer. And I don't know how I ever got into that one. And I really didn't like it because my parents would not allow me to take those classes in school because that was the devil's work. And I had real problems with that. But I used to love to listen to jazz music, and I would, I'd hide in the closet so God wouldn't see me and playing these records and listening, you know, because I knew he had a clipboard and my name was up top and I had a lot of stuff going on down bottom. And I heard a man at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous say one night, "We are sick as our secrets." And I didn't know that at that time that wasn't a terrible secret to have, but, you know, I knew it was against the principles of my family and their religion that I loved this kind of thing and I wanted to be in show business. So I started hooking that school and going to hanging in the movies a lot. Now, when I grew up in Georgia, it was a dry state. I don't remember at the time, you know, they didn't have package stores, and I never saw alcohol. In sobriety, I've learned that there was always illegal alcohol around, but I didn't know anything about that, and I didn't know alcohol existed on the planet Earth. So I was hanging in these movies day and night, you know, every time I got a chance to, because I was free from those restrictions. And walking down the street one night, I heard this great music coming out of a door, and these people walked out, and I said to my friend, a friend of mine who had gone to the movies with me, I said, let's just go in there and see what they do. And we walk into this jazz club. It was at a jazz era, which was absolutely wonderful. And we walk into this club. It was dimly lit. I still remember the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and down at the end of the bar was this rather portly lady grinding out this blues music. Man, my heart just started beating with excitement. And it's called living, that feeling is called living on the edge. I'm a bumper sticker watcher, and I was going through Beverly Hills recently, and the car ahead of me said, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. And so I sat there on that stool, and the bartender leaned over, and he said, well, you're going to have a drink. And I didn't know, but I remember in the movies they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip-slick cool act. And I leaned on that bar, and I looked at him, and I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. I didn't know what a dry martini was, but that's what they said. This guy puts these two-stem glasses up there, and it was this can, and he evened it out. It looked like lemonade. Now, I didn't know you sip drinks. And in Georgia, it's hot in the summertime, and, you know, we drink a lot of lemonade. And I just looked up and down that bar. I picked it up, and I dumped it. Pig from the gate. Here I was, about 19 years old, and never had a date, terrified of boys. My mother always said to me, stay away from boys, but she never told me why. I had a lot of mixed messages growing up, and I had always had these fantasies about dating, and, you know, I couldn't wear lipstick and all this stuff. And I walk out on this dance floor and with this glass still in my hand, and I look around, and I got myself some new friends right away. I call them colorful, but the big book calls them loyal companions. And I hooked up with the pimps, the madams, the hookers, and the bad boys. And I learned how to walk that walk and talk that talk. And I know all about street life, and I want to tell you something. My favorite jazz artist today is Randy Crawford, and she sings a song about street life. And I paraphrase the words when she said, if you're young, don't get old in the streets. Cold's going to hit you in the back, you're going to nickel and dime your life away. And you look back one day, it was all a masquerade. And I sat in my first few meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and looked back over that, and, you know, and I had almost nickeled and dimed my whole life away. Out there playing those games, I met a nice young man one night sitting on the bar stool, and we got married, and he came from a similar background. He didn't know much about drinking either. And we just kind of loved it together. And we stayed in that relationship for 24 years. The sickest relationship I think the two human beings could have been in. But I did an inventory. I've done an inventory on every person whose life I have affected, and I've taken responsibility for my relationships and the dangerous things and the things that I did in those relationships. And you know, there's something about the steps that it tells you about, that the truth will set you free. And I was able to, you know, move past that. We had a little son, and we used to shove this little son off on my ex-husband's parents to raise. And that was my first experience in going into visiting my child and seeing that look in their eyes, in his eyes. There's something about the way they look at you. And I always felt so guilty, and I could feel the pain, but, you know, my lifestyle was much more important for me than to be there with that little boy nurturing him. There's a paragraph in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that described the kind of practicing alcoholic I was, when it says, selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say that we are driven people. And we are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And I could have added on to that list, but when that I look at that little boy and he says he grow up, they do grow up, and he'd say things to me like, Mom, you promised them, you know, to take me to the park, but you never show up. And I would pat him on the head and I'd say, you know, next time. Get back in that car and get downtown and call upon the nearest Boston one. And on, you know, it was this time of the jazz era when I was hanging in those clubs. And I became very friendly and used to hang out with the late great legend. A lot of you, I look around, are very young, would certainly not remember that era. But I started pounding around with the likes of the late great legend, Billie Holiday. Used to drink with her and hang with her, Charlie Parker, Dinah Washington, Louis Armstrong, a lot of the great, you know, a lot of the great stars of the time, Sarah Vaughan, and I was in those clubs, in and out. You know, Bill Wilson, the co-founder of our program, that I believe that this program is divinely inspired, he was also a jazz lover, and he was in New York City, and he was in the clubs, and by this time, I am really, you know, fascinated with going from Boston to New York and back and forth, hanging in Harlem and, you know, and doing my thing. And I was doing all of this. And one morning I was sitting on the bar stool. My ex-husband's family had a moving company, and he was out of town a lot. And I'm sitting there on that stool. And I always was one of those people, I don't know about you, but I never had enough of anything. And I have learned in sobriety that I have a compulsive behavior. And what I always knew was that another secret was that there was some man out there that was going to take care of me and never question what my behavior. But he had some requirements that I needed to have, and that was that he's going to have to be rich, and he was going to have all those things, and I wouldn't have to worry about life, and life indeed was a bowl of cherries, and that I wasn't going to have to worry about. And if you hang in those clubs in Boston and New York and Harlem long enough, they show up. So I'm sitting there one morning in an after-hour joint, you know, drinking with Billie Holiday, and she introduced me to a guy that was standing there. He just appeared from out of nowhere. You know, I look up and there he is. And I want to describe this guy. He had a black hat turned down all the way around. He had a blue top coat over his shoulders. He was so cool, he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. He reached in his pocket, he pulls out this wad of money, he peels off 10 $100 bills, he spread it on the top of the bar like a deck of cards and leaned over and whispered, spend it. Now, I just told you guys I didn't believe in God, but there he was. And he turned out to be the head of the mafia of the Boston family. And then I learned what it was like to ride in a limousine with bodyguards. And, you know, the second step talks about God will restore us to sanity, and I was just totally insane by this time. We were driving along one Sunday morning, a beautiful Sunday morning, probably like this one, and I stopped at the stoplight. My little son's about 10 years old now, and I'm still out there doing that dance. And it was like a voice said to me as I looked at it across the street, and there were young families standing on the corner, about to cross the street to one of those beautiful New England churches. And that little kid so dressed so beautifully. And it was like a boy said to me, Clara, something is wrong with your life. And I agreed, the problem was Boston. You know, if I just get out of Boston, things would change. So I went in and I got that husband together, and we picked up that little son, put him in the back of that car, and drove to L.A. because that was going to be the place where I was going to be a good mother and a good parent, and we were going to, you know, I was going to do those things that women did for their, you know, for the community, and when they and moms did for their children. So he sat in the back seat, a little strange. He didn't even know who he was. I didn't know what to talk to him about. Didn't know anything about him. And we moved to L.A. And, you know, I called upon the nearest bar stool. You know, I'm an alcoholic. You know, all those good intentions went out of the window because I called upon that stool. We had two other children there, and we went into a small business, and we tried to change our lifestyle, and that little business became successful. We went into property maintenance and management business, and it got successful, and I don't know what to do with success. See, success to me means you just buy more drinks for people and you buy more love. What I've realized in Alcoholics Anonymous, that love is not for sale. You know, love comes from the inside, and that's what I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, truly what it means to love somebody, what it truly means to reach out and touch somebody from the heart, you know, but I always figured that I could buy it. My brothers and sisters were all, you know, grew up in Atlanta, all become very successful in their careers. Some of them moved to the West Coast area. I had one sister who was a nurse for many years. And they started to see that change. We talk about that part of our alcoholism, the progressiveness of the disease. And I didn't even know I was an alcoholic. And one day I began to lose those things, and I started getting into a lot of trouble. And I started to drinking around the clock. But my cocktail hour went from 5 o'clock, you know, down to 3 and down to 12 and down to 6. 6 o'clock in the morning, I'd be having a drink and saying, it's a cocktail hour somewhere in the world. You know, it's 5 o'clock somewhere in the world, so I might as well have it at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I got into a lot of violent behavior with that husband, and he left. You know, we made a decision that either he was going to kill me or I was going to kill him in one of those blackouts. And he left, and there I was with these three kids. That older son was 12 years older than the two that were born in Los Angeles. And I went to this sister when it was all beginning to go. Thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed. Came that time in my life when I needed to stop drinking, I needed to stop dying, and I needed to stop doing that dance. I ended up, with the bank foreclosing on the house, you know, the internal revenue, owed them thousands of dollars on payroll taxes. The house was gone, the cars were gone, and I went to this sister and I said to her, help me. I'm also a double winner. I'm a member of Al-Anon, and they didn't know anything about Al-Anon, but I remember saying to her, help me. Save me one more time, and she said, not this time. And I'm sure my loving God was working in their lives for me. And she said to me, you know, it pains me to watch you live the way you live, but it pains me even more to watch you die. And I'm not going to, we're not going to bail you out of any more trouble. And she said, but I tell you what we will do for you because we love you. And that is, we're going to pray for you, and I've come to believe in the power of prayer. And I went back to that house, and I stood outside the house with a little bag and those three kids. The older son looked at me, and he said, don't count on me to go with you down to that ghetto to watch you die. And he said, I don't even know who you are. And I'm standing there looking at him, and, you know, he's 18 years old now, man, and, you know, he's not a little boy with sad eyes because of a mother who lied to him all the time. Tears in his eyes, but they didn't run. Guess it wasn't macho for an 18-year-old young man to cry over a drunken mother who was now beginning to wake up with strangers for the price of a drink. And he turned and he walked away. And I'm standing there, you know, and I wanted to say to him, but you don't understand. I'm doing the best I can. If I knew better, I'd do better. But my arrogance picked up the bag and said, screw you. And we went on down there, and I ended up one morning, another Sunday morning, my loving God getting my attention in Daniel Freeman Hospital, a little hospital right outside of the ghetto area. One, still trying to be a party girl. You should have seen me. That wig was, I was living under that, and I remember going to a party up in Hollywood that night. But that Sunday morning, I came to on the South Central Los Angeles on a street called Crenshaw, and I was on the street between the curb and the street, and I remember a black boot was kicking me in the head, and I could kicking me in my ribs, and I could still hear my ribs cracking. You see, I know about pain, I know about physical pain, and I know about emotional pain, and that pain has no memory. I'm living the life so beautifully described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous of the jaywalker. I'm doing insane things all the time with insane people and expecting a different result. I changed bars, changed men, changed these things that I thought was going to make it better, and I would end up in the same places, you know, in that place of total devastating problem that I couldn't solve, and I didn't know what was wrong and why all of this was going on in my life. And I come to on a gurney in that hospital on a Sunday morning with paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. How many times did I sit in that chair, you know, contemplating suicide, only to learn that in Alcoholics Anonymous that suicide is a final solution to temporary problems. Two nuns standing by the bed, an older nun, probably a lady in her late 60s, who wasn't thrilled with me at all, because I was giving her a lot of lip. I'm the kind of person that always gave people a lot of lip when I was the most afraid. You know, I mean, stay away from me, I'm bad, you know, but inside I'm dying because I'm so afraid. And she turned, and because I wouldn't talk to the police who was standing at the foot of the bed, she turned and she walked to the door, and she turned and looked back at me. She had on horn-rimmed glasses, and she had her hands in the sleeves, and she just shook her head sadly. It was something about the way she did that touched me. You know, I mean, everybody had told me how I could stop drinking. They had told me all these things that would work if I just stopped drinking. But the young nun stood there, and she's probably not more than 24 years old. And I've come to believe in earth angels. I looked up at that young nun. She had on a gray habit, and all I could see was this part of her face. And what I remember is her eyes were as blue as the heavens. This young nun started to cry. She looked down at me, and I had this brain concussion, and the tears were falling on the covering of the bed. The police walked away, and she looked at me quietly and said, "How did you ever let your life get into such a state?" I had no answers for this young nun, but I felt something that was different. The same feeling I had looked at the older nun. And, you know, 3 days later, they had taped me up with 2.5-inch adhesive tape. In those days, they put the gauze around your ribs, then they rolled the tape off and tightened it up so tight that you couldn't stand up straight. So we're down 3 days later, and this same young nun, I know she must be my earth angel, was assigned to dress me out of all those nuns in that hospital. You should have seen her trying, you know, we got on my jacket over my shoulders because I can't put it on. And you should have seen her, you know, with that wig. She was kind of pushing it around. And she was trying to get those bangs in the right place. And I remember she looked at me, patted me on the head, and she said, "I think this will be good enough." And we walked out to the in front of that hospital. She put her arms around me, the spiritual being that she is. I have come to believe that we are all born spiritual beings, and we search for life in life's journey. We just take different roads. She stood there and she said, "Try not to drink today." I shuffle off to the nearest liquor store. Don't ask me if that's not insanity. I bought that wine and I was healing again, you know, with the drapes drawn, healing. And I came to that morning. I don't know what was different that morning about a lot of other mornings when I'd get up off that floor and make the run. I believe what happened to me was a divine intervention. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that people could get sober. All of my fair-weather friends and all the great jazz stars that I'd hung with, most of them were all dead from this disease. And there I am on that floor. Thank God that there was no stranger in that room that morning, because the men in my life by this time had faces and no names. And I can remember the stench of a dirty body because I had lost the will to care. And I came to, and I guess God just kissed me gently and said, "Child, get off the floor. You don't have to live like an animal again." And I stood up in that dirty room, and it was dark, and I can remember screaming, "God, please, if you're there, don't let me die." You know, the fear of death had always been my greatest fear from a very little girl. You know, I always would hear those things in church about if I wasn't a good girl, you know, I was going to burn to death, and I had that terrible fear of death, you know, because I knew I hadn't been a good girl. And I was just, you know, I was standing there, and I called my last friend who was not an alcoholic. And I said to her, you know, I think if I don't stop drinking, I'm going to die. And, you know, and I knew intuitively that that was the truth. And she said, well, I don't know, you know, we've been praying for you. She said, and I don't know anything about, there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, why don't you ask the operator and they'll give you the number. I'm sure they have a phone. And I picked up the phone and I called a central office. And a man answered the phone. He said, good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you? I said, my name is Clara, man. And I said, and I can't stop drinking. And I finally told the truth. And he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, and don't drink today. Now, that seemed like a far-fetched thing for an intellectual like me telling me don't drink today. And, you know, because drinking was a way of life. And I used to sit in that chair, and I want to tell you guys something. I used to have this innate feeling that if I stopped drinking, it maybe would get better. My greatest fear is, how do you live sober? See, I was afraid to get sober because I didn't think I could live sober. So he told me where to go to a meeting, and here I just told you my story and my arrogance, and I say to them, do you have meetings in Beverly Hills? And he said, yes, we do. He said, but you're going to the meeting in your neighborhood. My brother was working for Delta Airlines, and I called him, and these are the words I said to him. I think I found a place for me, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're going to help me stay sober. And I need a car to get to the meeting, because I'd been down there for 2 years without a car. And he said, well, on my way home from work, he said, he worked the night shift. He said, I'll bring the car back for you in the morning. So that morning, he brought the car, and he told me we hoped it was going to work for me. And I started to get dressed that morning for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hope I never had that experience again. Because I didn't know anything about the language here, and I have learned that the language is indeed the language of the heart. And I didn't know about detox, and I just didn't know what was going to happen. But what I heard from the stranger on that phone that morning was hope. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It is about hope, newcomers. And I hope you just listen to that. And so I was got up. I was still up, and I was still walking around for the first time in many, many mornings. Those kids came out of that dirty bedroom they slept in and went in that kitchen. I'm standing in the kitchen. You should have seen them cutting their eyes at me, you know, because I hadn't been in there for a long time. And and I helped them with their breakfast that morning. I helped them make their lunch. And it was something about just that gesture. It made me feel a little better about myself. Went to that closet door, what to wear, because I wanted to look good. I don't know what you guys were about. I'm standing in the closet. You know, I got a red velvet dress, and it's hanging there, and it's got wine stains on it. And I'm looking at this one dress and trying to make a decision. On what to wear. Got it out, cleaned up the wine stains, got that wig out, put it on the head farm. You ladies know what I'm talking about. I brushed it up, put a little hairspray on. She looked really good, you know. 12 o'clock, man, I'm bouncing. My body still like a motor, you know, and I can't stay still. I'm perspiring. I don't know what is wrong. But you know what? I was determined not to go to the liquor store. Around 2 o'clock, I couldn't stand the pain. I'm bouncing back and forth. When I grew up in Georgia, my dad used to take us to the zoo sometimes after church on Sundays. And I used to remember those animals walking around. In those days, they kept them in cages. And it would be going around. And that's just, I felt like an animal, bouncing back and forth. So to get out of the house, I went over to Woolworths just to browse. And while I was browsing, I stole some eyelashes. But my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They come quite long, and I didn't know I was supposed to trim them down to size. It was an 8 o'clock meeting, 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror, perspiration pouring off me. I got the dress on, it's a little too tight, and I get these lashes, and they come with a little tube of glue.
Gosh.
You know, when I get him on there, I grab my elbow and I wait for an opportune moment. I slammed that lash in and one end was up here and one end was down there. And I'm too tired to start all over. I lean in the mirror. I say, "You are looking good." Went off to my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. Walked up that walk, and I'm glad the man at central office didn't tell me it was a church. I made a commitment when I left Atlanta. I was never going to put my foot in the church again. But I remember that feeling of surrender. I looked up, put my hands up, and said, "Whatever." Walked up to that door, called Scotty, my friend, who's about 38 years now, was the greeter. He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, get yourself a cup of coffee and have a seat. In those days, they had, in all the meetings, they had real cups in those days. And I went over and I got myself a cup of coffee and filled it too full, but I didn't want you to see me shaking. Put it back on the table, and I went and sat on the first row in the first seat by the aisle. On my hands, because my body was just like it was going to blow apart. We detoxed in meetings in our Alcoholics Anonymous in those days, and I took a quick glimpse of my life. You know, they talk about what the drowning man sees, and when I look back over my life, I realized that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity, had stripped me of all moral values, and all family values, and all Christian values that wonderful family and my loving parents had tried to teach me, you know, when I was growing up in Atlanta. They started the meeting. They asked for the hands of the newcomer, and I didn't know what that was. And the lady behind me touched me on the shoulder and said, "Raise your hands, honey. You're a newcomer." And at the coffee break, she came up to that pot, and she, you know, and I was leaning against the table, and she had written her name on a little piece of paper, and she said, "My name is Carol, and this is my phone number. Go home and call me. I will tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about." And I did go back to the ghetto that night, picked up that phone, and I called Carol, and she told me about the pre-am of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she told me we'd go to meetings. And that year of 74, there were about 20 of us that got sober. All newcomers together, we all hung in there with each other. And out of that 20, 5 have passed away of natural causes, and the other 15 are still sober. Not one of us have ever gone out. We learned right away about service, and we learned right away about what to do with the steps. We learned that my sponsor made me get a job, and probably one of the young men that I got sober with, his name is Sean A. I'm sure a lot of you have heard Sean. He lives in Canada now. I'm 2 weeks older than he is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never let him forget that. So the first thing my sponsor told me to do is I had to get a job. I wasn't too thrilled by that news that I was going to have to work. She said, "You know, the mafia does not take care of you anymore. And now we are self-supporting through our own contribution. You get a job." I said, "But I don't know how to work." She said, "Well, I don't care what you do. And you get a job. I don't care what you do. They'll train you." So I got my first job was as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. You know, in my home group, I used to go in every meeting. I went to 13, 14 meetings a week for my first 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. All of that little group of us did. And I used to go in there whining about what they were doing to me out there. And I remember one night, you know, this old gentleman came out of the back of the room after we said the Lord's Prayer and the Amen, and he said, "Clara, please come down off the cross." He said, "We need the wood, honey." So I got better at that job. They told me to change my attitude. I think that's been almost a spiritual experience with me, is changing my attitude. And I changed my attitude, and I got to be a good waitress. And I always thank the couple that owned that little coffee shop that just gave me a job and put up with me. And you know, I learned how to suit up and show up on time. I was taught that, to suit up and show up on time and give a full day's work for a full day's pay. And I started to learn something about self-worth as a result of that. By the time I was three years sober, I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, I think I'd like to go back into that business I drank away. It's probably the only thing I really knew how to do. I said it would be a good career for me in sobriety, and she agreed. And I went to my home group guys, and they showed me how to go get business cards, and I went over in Beverly Hills on my day off from my waitress job, and I passed out my little cleaning. I was going to clean houses to get started, and finally a lady hired me. And boy, you know, I was so good. You know how we are. We got to be perfectionists, whatever it is. I cleaned her house so good, I went out and bought Q-tips and cleaned the keyholes. She was really impressed. But she told all her friends about it, and pretty soon I had a booming business. I have a company now, 21 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've learned and I've done exactly whatever it took for me. I have contracts to the homes of the rich and the famous. I have contracts, and I have sent crews into the homes of the movie stars and the political figures in Los Angeles. In 1990, I brought my daughter into my company as a full partner. That's the little daughter. I could never get to her PTA meeting. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous gives us, you know, I bet back those relationships. And I was able to see that daughter go into the ice capades. When I was 5 years sober, her grandparents had paid for that expensive training. And she was the first black professional skater, ice skater, with Dorothy Hamill's tour. And my little son that had to go to that ghetto when I was 7 years sober, he attempted suicide, and today he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you, Cheryl, with you, when we grow in Alcoholics Anonymous, we start to get those things back. Because when I was about 4 years sober, I started, you know, and now I bought this nice little Spanish house. I still live in it. And I bought this big car, and, you know, I'm beginning to hear the music and the insanity returns. Now, there's a little paragraph in the book that says, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. That defense must come from a higher power. But it's insidious, the disease, how it started to whisper. And I started lying to my sponsor, sneaking off after meetings, going to the jazz clubs around L.A., you know, because I could hear the clinking of the ice and the glass again. And here I am, always forgetting, standing in front of the liquor store door waiting myself some morning. The phone rang, and God's calling me again. A lady said, Clarence, we have a 12-step call from central office, and we would like to know if you would take it. Well, I wasn't really thrilled about this. How dare they call me? Forgot about that morning when I called off a dirty floor. How easy we forget. How easy we forget. And I said, you know, there are a lot of people in Alcoholics. Listen to this one. There's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have a lot more time than I do, who are very effective at 12-step calls. And I don't think I have enough time to. And she said, "Oh, stop it." She got annoyed with me. And I said, "I had always heard, you know, that you never turn down an AA request." And I said, "Well, I better take the information. What is it about?" She said, "And where is it?" She said, "Well, her name is Dorothy, and she's down on downtown Skid Row. She called us this morning that she needs help." And I said, "Well, all right." And I took the information. And I called my sponsor. I run this by her. I said, "You know, I just had a call from central office." And I said, "You know, there's a lot of people around that have a lot more experience than I do." My sponsor isn't saying a word. I said, "The truth is," I said, "I don't want to do it." And she finally said, "I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway." And she hung up. I always heard you never, you know, go on a 12-step call alone. So I'm sponsoring this little Hollywood actress. She's got about 90 days. Pick up the phone, call her. I said, we're going on a 12-step call. She says, where? I said, it's down on Skid Row. She said, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. I said, you get over here. So we get in my big Eldorado man, and we wheeling downtown, you know, and the lady at central office had told me, she's not, you know, this, there's no marquee outside. It's just got a number above the door. It wasn't part of the Hilton chain, I'll tell you that. So we go in the door, and I don't see anybody around. All these alcoholics are in there dancing. They had a big boombox radio up on the shelf. And this is romance in the lobby of a flea-bitten hotel, and it smelled like a latrine. And they're cheek-to-cheek, and they're wine, you know, cheek-to-cheek dancing, and they're wine balls and beer cans all over the place. So it had a long arrow along the wall that said, ring this bell for attention, and I rang this bell. And I was about to experience, the 12-step talks about a spiritual awakening as a result of a 12-step call that changed my whole life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I realized, you know, I was going to see the depths of this disease from through the eyes, my eyes to someone else, because nobody saw mine with the drapes drawn. So we get on this elevator, we go up to the third floor, we stop over these three drunks that were down in the hall, and we knock on them this door at the end of the hall. We walk into a little room, and on the floor was a 20-year-old blonde young woman who was turning blue because she was gagging on her own vomit. And we looked at each other, and we turned her over, and we pushed on, and it popped out, because she was dying. We walked in there at that moment. And don't tell me that there isn't a God. And she was in this fetal position, and she had lost all body control. Water bugs were so huge that they crunched when they were on the floor like in mountains, and they crunched as we walked around in there. And my friend, that young woman and I, she's still sober too. She's just in Cleveland now. And we went over to the drawers, and we were going to dress her. And we picked her up, and we cleaned her up. And we put a little pink sweater on her, and we got her between us, and we got it down. We never spoke a word. I know today that God had us on a mission. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic and saving another alcoholic's life. We got on the elevator, got her downstairs, I called central office, they told me where to take her. We got her registered, and we went to a little all-night diner, still on Skid Row. I've started a lot of meetings on Skid Row as a result of this, of that 12-step call. I got into service, and in the service that I am still in. We were sitting across from her, and I started to talk about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous from my heart for the first time. I talked about the first step. You know, that we're powerless over alcohol. The second half of that first step says our lives are unmanageable. Talked about the second step, that God will restore us to sanity. And she stood up and said, hey, don't talk to me about God. And she said, everybody in my family is insane, and we're all dying of alcohol or drug addiction. And I got to the third step, and I said, we make a decision to turn our will and life over the care of God. She said, I told you, don't talk to me about God. And, you know, I think I had some unresolved anger. Because I reached across there and got her by that little pink sweater, pulled her forward, going to punch her lights out. But the step says having had a spiritual awakening. Doesn't say beat them up if they don't want it. I don't know what happened to Dorothy. And, you know, I hope she's sober somewhere in this world today, and I hope she's well. My life got better and things got better. That older son came back into my life when I was 3 years sober. And I'll close with this, that we don't drink no matter what. That son had walked out of my life, had gone into show business, actor, movies and television. And he'd been trained by ABC Television in New York. And he'd gotten a job there. They hired him in the news department. He used to call me, and he'd come back and forth to L.A. and we had, you know, worked out our closure, you know, and we'd worked out our peace. I remember saying to him, you know, when you were little and growing up, you know, I'm really sorry that I was never there for you. But I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't live like that anymore. And I realized that I was not a bad mother, but I was a sick person. And I did the best I could. And I remember that son looked at me and he said, well, Mom, that was yesterday. And he said, we're not promised tomorrow. And he said, let's just start this family. And the family after the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we started that family, you know, bonding from that point on. It was a wonderful experience. And when his tenure was over in New York, and he went back to Los Angeles, he got married, he had a little son. I have a little grandson. His name is Aaron. And, you know, God's given me a second chance because I have Aaron today as that little grandson. He was 12 years old last Saturday. And, you know, Aaron lives with his mother up in Northern California. And, you know, whenever he comes to visit me, I don't promise Aaron anything I don't want to do with him. You know, mostly we go to Toys R Us. But that son got married, and as I said, and then they had a divorce that didn't work, and then he was up north doing, you know, teaching theater arts at the college level. And he called me one day about 3 years ago, and he said, Mom, I went to the doctor today. And he said, you know what? He said, I tested HIV positive. And I learned that in New York what he had been doing was when cocaine first came on the streets, he was sharing intravenous drug using of cocaine and sharing the needle. And I couldn't believe it. And this time it passed, and I was shocked. And I do what you taught me to do. I put that phone down, and I said, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. I went to San Francisco, walked around San Francisco with that son, with my arms around him. And I want to tell you, my world fell apart. But I had my sponsors and my sponsees, and I call you guys Earth Angels of Alcoholics Anonymous, around me to support me, my daughter and my son, and the other son. And about 9, he said, I'm staying here because I'm okay now. And 19 months later, I got the other call. He said, Mom, he said, you know, it's time for me to come home because I'm going to die. Oh, my God, you know, here was another place that, you know, I had prepared a home for him to come to, and I couldn't be there when he was little. And that son came home. I had many hours that I sat by that bed, and we shared in our lives, and we told each other. And he said to me one day, Mom, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, because it gave us the mother we always wanted. And the lady we always knew you could be. And so it came that morning at 10:15. You know, and he, one of the members of the Rolling Stones had written him a song, the lyrics to a song that he asked us to sing. And my sponsor and my sponsees and friends and family stood around that bed, and we sang to him to help him cross that bridge. And suddenly at 10:15, that rasping sound of death was over. And it was silent. And he was gone. Last night, you know, the moment of silence for the loving members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, when we held our heads last night, a lot of that pain is in the last 6 years has been in my family. I've lost everyone. I have one sister left. And it's been going on and on and on. And I want to tell you something. My prayers is last night. I pray that all of their souls rode the wings of angels to a higher place. Where there's no more crying, and there's no more dying, and there's no more pain. And then it was over. And I stand here this morning full of peace and full of love. What I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous to face moments like that in moments to come. Life keeps happening. And it's rooms like this that you rendered me sober and you rendered me sane, and for that I'm eternally grateful to you for my life.